Welcome to Ask an Innovator, where we interview senior executives about innovation. You can find us at askaninnovator.com or subscribe with your favorite podcast app. I'm your host, Josh Barker, CEO of City Innovation Labs.
Today I've got with me Matt Kamerait. He is with AAR as the Director of Digital. So welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much, Josh.
Yeah, absolutely. So I always start out the conversation with what is innovation? How do you define it? Everyone has a different definition for it.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think of it in a few different ways, but the biggest is probably it's the process of how we together invent the future. So fundamentally, I think innovation doesn't happen in a vacuum or on your own or very often kind of, you know, as a solo inventor sort of thing. I think it tends to be when that's brought together with application and when multiple people bring skills, talent, et cetera, together to try to forge what that future looks like. And along those lines, I think the maxim that the future is here but not evenly distributed applies there as well, where some of it is about going out and kind of hunting for, you know, new capabilities, new technologies, and then finding ways to apply those to existing business problems. And if you ever forget one or the other of those two things, I think that's where innovation gets into trouble. If you only come with business problems and you aren't looking at the new technologies that are available, so you're trying to like rehash the old solution over and over, or if you're coming with just a new technology approach and you haven't really thought about the business problems or the needs that the people who actually are going to use the technology have, then you're solution hunting and you know, you can create a lot of cool engineering, but it may not ever see the light of day.
No one uses it. Yeah, that's good stuff. So, I mean, I'd love for you to tell the listeners a little bit about AAR and some of the things you guys do.
Yeah, definitely. So we're a $2 billion aviation company. We're pretty unique. We're probably the biggest in our space that's not either an airline or an OEM. And there are kind of two flavors of OEM, the what are called airframers, those who create the full plane, and then component OEM, so people who build parts that can go onto planes or be swapped out, whether those go into the original plane or come into the aftermarket later. But essentially, we do a huge business in trading, huge business in MRO. We work with a lot of those OEMs, and then we have other business units that kind of tie those together in one fashion or another.
Nice. And so you being the director of digital, you guys are making things for airplanes, and that's kind of your thing. And it's like, where does digital fit into this? I mean, I'm sure there's tons of digital stuff. I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So for us, our digital journey started coming up on 4 years ago, essentially. And I think we realized at that point that, IT was only going to go so far and that we had to start taking a different perspective in terms of technology that could impact the business. And so it started just as kind of a fledgling group at that point, went out and did an initial analysis of opportunities within the business and also things that we should be looking at out in the market. They put together some initial business cases based on that research and then basically made a proposal to expand the group. And that's around the time that I joined is essentially when we had the portfolio of things that we wanted to go after. And they really fell into two categories, either enabling people to do business with us easier, essentially, which are typically software products or offerings that come along with doing business with us in some existing way. So if you're buying parts from us or you're doing exchanges with us or you're taking advantage of our MRO services, you might have applications that enable that. And then the second category being net new digital offerings that we can sell to the market. That's the one that we're just cracking into right now with our first product, AirVolution.
Talk a little bit about AirVolution.
Sure.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. So AirVolution is a platform for what we call repair cycle management. So basically, in a given year for every single plane that you're operating, about 150 parts have to be taken off the plane and either tested, repaired, overhauled, and then, you know, certified to return back onto the plane as airworthy. So you
is
can imagine
like changing your oil sense with
yeah, but with
a little bit more
massive checklists. Imagine binders, you know, six inches thick.
Oh, yeah.
Of really prescriptive documentation.
Regulations and documentation.
Yep.
Yeah,
exactly right. Because you want 10 checks for anything that have to do with passenger safety or anything like that.
Yep.
So for any sizable airline, and even for the smaller ones, you can imagine how that 150 times the number of aircraft you have adds up in a hurry. You know, so for some of the top carriers, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of these repair orders flowing around, you know, in a given year. And so that creates a huge kind of logistics problem, just understanding where everything's at, where it's at in the process. And historically, you know, there are two KPIs that they really care about: turnaround time and then cost. And essentially, because of that lack of visibility or because of the complexity, they've always really managed towards turnaround time, and cost has been kind of a secondary factor. So what we see is a lot of, you know, kind of missed value that falls in that second category, and places where they're taking trade-offs and expediting things that, you know, if they had full visibility, maybe they could pull something that's similar that's later in the repair cycle or that sort of thing. Or if they just saw all of their historical data, they could compare the new price that they're getting quoted against that and see very quickly, does it match, you know, what the market is saying the price should be. And so this system gives them one place to do that, you know, brings together all of the different tools that they're expected to use today. You know, one thing we're seeing from them, and you know, we see this from OEMs, we even experience it ourselves, is sort of this system fatigue. So basically anybody that's working with, you know, a network of partners, which, you know, any enterprise naturally is being hit with systems from every single vendor that they're working with. And everybody wants to have their own portal and their own platform and, you know, kind of make software a critical part of how they're doing business. But fundamentally for, you know, the folks in the center of that wheel, they don't necessarily want 25 different tools that they have to go to manage all of that. So this is a system that's designed to bring together a bunch of those and then to make the lives easier of both the people performing the repairs and the airlines who are sending stuff out to be repaired.
Gotcha. Now, how did you guys come about figuring out this was a gap in the marketplace for Evolution, you know, and even validating that with some partners? Like, how did that come about?
Yeah, definitely. So about 6 or 7 years ago, we acquired outside company called Aranmar, and they were doing full service repair cycle management. So basically what Evolution does as software, they were doing with people. And so for folks who didn't want to kind of handle all of that repair activity in-house, or even if they wanted to handle some of it in-house, but not other things, this company was there to provide those kind of supplemental services to enable that, those back office functions, essentially. But as we were going out selling that, and especially now kind of as the market has changed and some of these what are kind of subscription style agreements have become much more popular. They're called PBH or Power by the Hour, which is essentially where instead of outsourcing just the repair activity, you're outsourcing the whole ownership and sort of life cycle of the part. So the second it comes off the plane, it belongs to whoever's providing that subscription. And it's up to them to always have, you know, a airworthy part ready for you to swap in so that you never have to worry about it. But that does come at a price premium. So for folks who want to manage that in-house, who don't want to put everything under Power by the Hour, or even who do but still want to keep track of where everything's at, you know, we were always asked, well, you know, is there an option to just use your systems or your solutions or the IP that you've developed from doing this for over 30 years, but without outsourcing it, essentially? Because just from a strategy standpoint, a lot of these airlines want to keep that competency in-house, because the longer you let it sit outside your walls, the less knowledgeable you are about it, and your ability to kind of smell test and check things kind of declines as a result. So what this solution does is it allows them to do exactly that. So to handle as much of it as they want in-house, to connect to all their different repair vendors, to see all that stuff in one place, reports, analytics, business intelligence, all in a single platform, and all as software as a service. So technically, they don't have to be doing any other business with us at all to use the platform. And it's really, you know, all of them interacting with their supplier base, which tends to include us in most cases, but doesn't have to.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I bet you guys offer then as almost like an add-on, or if they want the managed services, they could, or they could, you know, they could do either approach. Now you kind of offer the unmanaged version.
Yep, that's exactly right. And it can be modular too. So if they just want us to follow up on like warranty claims, or there are often these entitlements with the OEMs that are really difficult to claim back because the paperwork, but we're really good at it because we've done it for a long time. That's a good example of like a supplemental service that we can easily perform along with them using the software. And fundamentally, I think that's where the whole industry is headed. You know, aviation as a whole is very spiky. It's very cyclical, you know, tends to be tied very closely to commodity prices, especially energy prices. And so it goes through a lot of these peaks and valleys in terms of resources and kind of desire for new projects and things like that. So what this allows you to do is, instead of having to staff up and lay people off and staff up and lay people off, you essentially let us be your spike management approach. And then you can also automate a lot more and get more out of the same people that you have. So you need a smaller team to accomplish the same work as previous.
That's awesome. And how did, you know, does it look like, instead of AAR, Airvolution, the Airvolution team, does it look like a startup? Like, how is the team kind of structured? Are there obviously there's engineers, I'm assuming, all behind this, behind the scenes?
Yeah, definitely. I would say it is like a startup within a big company, and that's what really drew me to it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've spent about half my career in the startup world and half in big companies, and there are upsides and downsides to both. You know, in the startup world, you can be really agile. You can go after, you know, opportunities that you see. You can pivot really quickly, but things like, you know, funding are always a challenge, and commercialization always comes with a lot of risk, especially in sort of the venture-backed climate, you know, there's this sort of shoot for the moon or bust kind of dynamic there, which for every business opportunity isn't always the right match. On the enterprise side, you can end up with, you know, a lot of layers of approvals that you have to go through, but you have, you know, a known customer base, people that you have decades-long relationships with. And then the funding side tends to be a lot easier because you've got sort of known sources. You've got, in many cases, kind of structures that you can use in order to get funding for new opportunities and new projects. And so what I like about, you know, my role and how the digital group is structured is it's really meant to sort of bridge that and create, you know, some of the upside of, you know, being in a startup in a high growth environment, but also have sort of the backing and stability that comes with a big company.
Mm, that's awesome. Yeah. My past sounds very similar to your startup, big company.
Yep.
I always tell people, I'm like, I go into large companies because I'm burned out and I hide in them, and then not hide in them, but you know, you have the picture of getting some your breath and then going starting a new company and then doing that all over that cycle. So
yep.
Sounds like a similar approach.
Couldn't agree more. You know, and for me too, it's also about what season of life I'm in. You know, phrase I really like, it sounds a little cliche, but for a season, for a reason. And, you know, in a given season where you've got young kids, for example, you may want to be able to be home more. You may want to have less risk and volatility. But then at other times, you know, you may have a lot more flexibility to move somewhere interesting or jump on an opportunity. And so I think being able to kind of match, you know, the work climate and the culture to what it is that you're able to do in that season is really important.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like you're passionate about startups then. I'd love for you to explain what you and I were talking about just a second ago.
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of times there's this big chasm that exists between the startup world and between the enterprise world. And I don't think it necessarily has to be as big as it is today. And I think if you did have kind of more cross-pollination between those two groups, we'd see a mellowing in a sense of some of the negatives that come with, you know, each of those sort of setups. So I think a lot of times what you see from startups is that they want to go out, you know, build fancy new technology, get it to a point where it's, you know, really well baked, and then commercialize. So go out to the enterprise, get paid, and then go back and do it again, essentially. But fundamentally, you know, that makes the assumption that they, you know, nail the requirements and the needs and the pain points of that enterprise, you know, when they go out to do that. And if they haven't, then there's a big sort of retrenching process that has to happen in order for them to do that. And on the enterprise side, a lot of companies, you know, and we're getting better at this, but I see it, you know, with every big company I've ever worked with, access to the startup world tends to be a challenge.
Yeah.
Interfacing with them sort of on their terms and understanding where they're at in their life cycle and technology readiness and that sort of thing can be a challenge because they're often either used to being sold like fully baked solutions, or the other posture is we have to invent everything in-house. You know, and I see both of those flavors. But if you're able to kind of open that up and take more of a build by partner approach and be a little bit more agnostic and engage with startups along the way, I think you're much more likely to succeed. And you also then get more of a portfolio in terms of risk and opportunity. Mm. And fundamentally, when you make just small big bets or single big bets rather, you're really kind of creating a lot of risk density essentially there, where if you've got a bunch of investigations going on, you may have several that don't work out, but you have other horses in the race essentially that right. You can capitalize on.
Yeah. Do you see this cooperation happening in any of the industries that you see? Like, as you're in, the aircraft industry, are you seeing that from an outside perspective helping AAR, or is that something you're just kind of making note as you've been observing startups and enterprises?
So it's something we've been doing a little bit, but I think we could do a lot more of. I think even within the industry, we're fairly far ahead in terms of the level of engagement that we do have, because I see a lot of both airlines and OEMs who are not engaging, to as great of an extent. One exception might be Boeing. I'd say Boeing does a good job. They've got a big kind of innovation competency. It's been a core competency for many, many years. And they also have like a venture arm that's pretty significant in terms of its size and scope. But even the venture arms within a lot of the big enterprises are often set off to the side, partially to avoid conflict of interest and that sort of thing. But I think you lose some of that knowledge capture opportunity that comes from directly interfacing with the startup and sort of understanding the challenges that they're going through and what the next set of milestones is and why that matters for them, essentially. Mm. Because a lot of times I think people are not aware of all the things that each side has to offer one another along the way. They often think it's only at this moment of like a finished product and a paid transaction that there's, value to be created. But both in terms of discovery, so the startup learning more about, how things could be used or what the actual constraints or challenges are, because sometimes they're, the complexity of what's needed is actually less than what they're shooting for, and they could commercialize sooner if they knew about that. And then on the big company side, being exposed to things that are not at like, a full technology readiness of 9 or whatever, that are still back at like, not in the lab, not several years out, but within a year or two of being sort of, mature and ready to go. It takes that long for a big company to like implement a new technology anyway. So if they can see those things that much further down the road, then they're sort of ready to implement them as soon as they're ready, rather than that time clock of a year or two starting from the point that they're ready, which is when people end up playing catch up.
Yeah, good observations. I mean, is this something in the next, so asking you in a broad strokes question, the industry that you're in, so the, where do you see that headed in the next 3 to 5 years? And where do you see this, because you're passionate also about startups working with these enterprises. Where do you see those two things kind of heading in the future? Is there some maturity happening you believe will happen?
Yeah, so I think when I look at aviation, the trend has been pretty similar. You could go back to the early 80s, maybe even further, where it's like long-term good, long-term growth. So the growth of the middle class worldwide basically means that people are consuming more air travel, essentially. Mm. And so that march is always going on. But then within that, you have these energy cycles, essentially. So those commodity cycles that play out within it. And there's a little bit of kind of a boom bust that happens within that. One thing I'd like to see the industry do is take advantage of new technology to sort of smooth that out in a greater fashion, or at least to have better visibility into it. Because I think oftentimes there's a little bit of a rush to like start new projects during the boom cycle and then have to like pull back on them or pause them when you go into, one of the harder times or cutback cycles. But if we know that this is going to happen, you don't always know, the phase or the interval, that it's going to be the next wave, but that next wave is coming. So if you can plan for it and kind of load level, a little more effectively, I think that would go a long way. Lots of other big trends we're seeing, the connected worker, is a really huge one. Kind of the combination of man and machine in a much more aggressive way than we've ever seen before. My prior life before this, and one of the things I've been doing for the last 9 years is working in augmented reality hardware and software. And so I think, that technology coupled with brain computer interface, coupled with artificial intelligence are really going to change what the individual is able to do, and also allow us to much better match the individual with the task, and fundamentally we see that as a huge challenge today. I mean, we have labor shortages in the skilled trades and in mechanics,
yeah.
Kind of across the network, especially kind of at the high point seasonally. So finding, you know, that quality talent, training up new talent to be able to, you know, supplement that, and then, you know, matching them to the tasks that they're going to be most effective at. I think there's huge opportunity for those technologies to transform that.
Mm, that's good. That's great. Yeah, and I could see AI and I could see augmented reality. We were talking to someone the other day about, it's a construction company. And they, I mean, it blows your mind what those techs even combined can do together. And like AR, just being able to, for a construction company, look at a wall and see into the wall, mm-hmm. of where the pipes are and where the, it just blows my mind of the tech and the opportunity that brings. And I'd imagine applying that to mechanics or anything like that, of being able to find where things are easily and see just by putting on AR kind of goggles, so mm-hmm. to speak, and glasses. Huge opportunity, I'd imagine.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think too, we're also going to see that each of those technologies don't have to live in a vacuum. So, you know, a progression to me from like virtual reality for classroom training to augmented reality on site to then progressively actually less and less assistance on the things that you're performing on a regular basis, where it then becomes sort of this subtle coach that's sitting over your shoulder,
right.
that you can ask, you know, whenever you need assistance, but gets out of your way when you don't need it, which actually allows the attention management to be much better and the decision fatigue and that sort of thing to not be as big a deal. Because when you see people sort of use it for one chunk of time and then not use it the rest of the day, that's usually the reason why, is essentially it's overkill for things that they do on a regular basis and underkill for,
right.
you know, the things that are really high complexity, essentially.
Right.
So I think, you know, we'll see that dramatically transform, you know, how people do work. I think it's actually going to extend, you know, kind of the gig economy thing that you see today to the point where fewer people will be coupled to a specific company, and they'll be able to use devices like that to basically be issued tasks from any company based on their skills and their location. And then you'll have sort of the distributed enterprise, essentially, which is sort of a dream for both the enterprise, because then they've got, you know, the right labor in the right place at the right time, and they're not paying to fly people, you know, all over the place for remote work or that sort of thing. And they're able to, you know, use the skills that are already there, that are latent, that are just difficult to tap into today because people are sort of, you know, tied to a single organization.
Well, absolutely.
And then eventually the device too will go away, and it'll all be in the visual cortex.
Yeah, in our brains.
Your brain.
Yeah.
You'll get it as a baby, like a vaccine, and it'll build itself within your body.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're dreaming big. I mean, it's going to happen someday.
Might be a little longer than 10 years, but we'll see. Yeah.
That's good. Now, through this whole process and through your career, what have you learned in terms of innovation or building digital products? What are some things that are really, if you could say, these are the key things or key takeaway that you'd want to say to the audience or that person?
Yeah. I'd say one of the biggest, and I say this a long time, but a little bit of process goes a long way. You know, I think there's again, sort of danger at the end points of, you know, lack of balance when it comes to process. So on the far end to the startup side, you can fly by the seat of your pants, not really have a process, be making stuff up as you go, often because you're doing something for the very first time and nobody's ever done it before. But then on the enterprise side, you typically have a process for everything. You've got lots of SOPs, you've got ways that different business units interact with one another. And so essentially you get these things that are kind of entrenched. And anytime you try to deviate from that known process, it becomes really challenging, or you see a lot of friction. So if you live in sort of that midpoint where you've got a little bit of process, but not too much, there's a tremendous amount you can do. The way I see that within an innovation context is I always try to apply just like a four-step process, essentially. So smell test initially, and basically each step you're applying progressively more resources, you're reducing risk as you move through each step, and then you're getting closer to sort of a sure thing. And it gives everybody involved kind of more comfort and visibility with those steps along the process, and gives them a roadmap for where they're headed. So smell test initially, very lightweight, research focused, you know, understand the opportunity, the potential technologies that could go into it, and then say, you know, hey, this looks interesting, we should we should take a closer look. Next step, build by partner. So recognize that you're not the only one who can go out and create technology. Recognize there may be things out there that you should take a look at, whether they accomplish part of what you're trying to do and you can put them together with something new you create. Or in many cases, there's a service offering that, you know, you can use kind of as is and save a whole bunch of time in terms of having to create something new. So build by partner and be open truly to all three of those essentially. And then from there, pilot. You know, and pilot can be a lot of different things. It can be a small experiment. It can be a cross-sectional pilot. Sometimes if it's a big technology or a big change, you can have multiple phases to that. And then sort of a final business case or a report out, which is really when you stand and deliver to the organization and say, you know, this is what we found. This is the build by partner combination that we think makes sense. And here's what it'll take to really go after this. And then you get the go, no go. And I think by having a portfolio that's progressing through those four, knowing that you're going to have stuff down selected at every stage, you know, then you've got a process that people can count on, something that people can tap into for knowledge and experience and talent, even on the projects that don't work out. But then the things that do, because they have that sort of single rail or that little bit of process, they can move that much faster. And then you can start to measure things like innovation velocity or, you know, how competent are you at taking things through that progression efficiently and effectively.
That's some great, great lessons learned. I mean, I really like that progression because a lot of companies, especially the big ones that have that, some of the things they do is they have because they have a lot of funding, sometimes they'll just take it from, hey, I've got an idea, let's go build it right away, the whole thing. I like that your progression is working to reduce risk along the way with building things that are fast and cheap and just validating it. And that's what it kind of sounds like
yep.
through that process. So that makes a lot of sense, especially for a large company to kind of go through a process like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, and there's a temptation too. Some people will mistake like agility or kind of the startup style mentality for just green lighting those things at that really early stage. And so they'll be like, oh, you know, we jump on opportunities when we see them. But if you're throwing $2 million in 2 years at it and building up an entire team, you're not really doing kind of that initial homework. And what you end up doing is put a lot of pressure and risk on that opportunity that you've gone after. And also, 6 months from then, when you see another opportunity, you're already kind of pot committed to the one that you're working on. So your ability to then weigh those opportunities versus one another is way off balance because you're going to look at the one that you've already funded, you've already said is a good idea as sort of the horse that you have in the race, essentially.
Right.
The other thing that I think people do that leads to that is in big companies, especially, you know, and this is true even in very innovative big companies, the temptation for kind of the most senior person in the room to just sort of give what the choice is going to be or to select from the opportunities and go after them. I think one of the subtle benefits of the kind of four-step process that I described is that, you know, things that maybe don't seem like a great idea to like a CEO or a head of a business unit or something like that at the initial stage may still be worth a smell test because there are likely things that people just don't have visibility into or kind of knee-jerk assumptions they're making about those things that are borne out through that process that if you just say go or no go at that initial phase, you tend to go with, you know, the most senior person's opinion and doesn't always lead to the best
That's
result.
That's right. Yeah. And oftentimes, if you have that one person kind of trumping everyone or being the loudest voice, we always say throw bad ideas at the wall. If you allow that to happen as you throw these bad ideas out there, we find that, well, they're bad ideas because maybe they're too expensive or they're too X and they're immediately discounted. But that idea then if it's bad initially, it could be bolstered by another idea and combined with another one. And then you end up saying, well, that wasn't originally possible, but now combine it with three other ideas that came from three different people. Now it's possible.
Totally.
And
I think marking those things. So when you sunset a project out of this, I think it's also really crucial that you don't just drop it and throw away everything that you've done. Mm. Oftentimes kind of cataloging those things, I call them triggers for that opportunity making sense. So one of my first companies, we were looking at like a biodiesel concept for big trucking fleet. And it was like, well, if gas prices were, you know, above $4 a gallon, you know, this would make a lot of sense. But if they're below that, it doesn't make any sense. And at the time, gas was like, you know, $2.30 or something like that. So it was like not even close. So it's tempting at that stage to just be like, this is a bad idea, doesn't make any financial sense. But what you really should do is put it, you know, in a queue that says, if gas prices hit $4 a gallon or stay above that threshold for X amount of time, then we should revisit this and basically pick up right where we left off and jump on it. And then you're that much further ahead to go after those opportunities. And I think there's huge sort of intellectual property value to that pile of ideas that aren't moving forward right now, but that have known triggers or things that you can be looking out for or measure, you know, to say, hey, this is something that we should revisit or that might make sense now.
Right. Love that. Yeah. You don't want to forget all the lessons learned. You know, in the startup world, what do they say? The measure of progress is not revenue traditionally, it's learnings. How fast are you learning?
Yep.
And so that makes a lot of sense. You don't want to throw away all your learnings from what you spent all this time.
Oh, yeah. Well, and if you do, you end up repeating the mistakes of the past over and over.
Yes.
And I've seen that time and again. Basically, it's night and day when you have an innovation process or you don't, in terms of when you don't, you find yourself going, well, I think 2 years ago, somebody looked at this,
right,
or there was somebody in this group that was doing something with it. And maybe that person's still around. Maybe you can go talk to them, but maybe not. And in a lot of cases, they don't have, you know, all the documentation of what they did. And so you can find yourself sort of reliving this past history of
Groundhog
things that
Day.
Didn't work out. Yeah, exactly. In the worst possible sense, you know, whereas if you build up sort of that institutional knowledge and that shared history, you know, that becomes a playbook for both what you're good at and what you're able to capitalize on, but also what you should leave alone.
Right. Good stuff. Well, I appreciate, Matt, you jumping on and talking to me about innovation. Any other things that you'd want to add?
I would encourage people on both sides of the fence, both those in the startup world and the enterprise world, to kind of spend more time with one another. And doesn't always have to be in a formal sort of pitch context, whether that's investment or a sales conversation. But I'd really encourage them to sort of not think of themselves as two different flavors, because ultimately, they're both trying to do the same thing. They're both trying to create value. They're both trying to capitalize on the opportunities that are in front of them. And if they come together on that common ground, I think there's a lot they can learn from one another.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Well, thanks again, Matt. Appreciate that. It's been an awesome time just to chat.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Ask an Innovator. Visit us on our website, www.askaninnovator.com. This podcast has been sponsored by City Innovation Labs.